what we'd like to do, we know that there are very much who have been engaging the work of these scholars in various ways, and a couple of graduate seminars specifically, which have looked at this work and the confluence between the three writers. So what we'd like to do is to enter into that sort of a conversation. And I know that some of the students have questions or comments that they'd like to make. And so we want to open it up for that and then see where that conversation, where that conversation takes us. Is that okay? So I'll just ask if any of these students particularly, and then other folks will open up to, but any of the students particularly have questions from your reading of the work and or from the conversation that we witnessed this year.
How are folks doing? How are you all doing? You good?
I have a question back here, even though I'm the translator. In reading your work, particularly Dr. Alexander, I would like to hear more about how we can incorporate spirituality in the work that we do in this classroom. Because when I read your work, that's the part that was very important for me, because I come from Brazil and I feel like, you know, spirituality in many ways, particularly if you're talking about the tradition of Candomblé and these particular traditions, it's to me it feels like when you come to a tradition, you have to completely turn your back against that side, that dimension, that very important dimension of the human being. And in some ways, I think you can be looked down upon if you try to bring this kind of dimension into your world in traditional institutions, which is the case of this institution here, and many other institutions where I suppose will be getting a job in the future.
Should we take a set of questions and then that way we can all...
It's a good idea.
Yeah.
This is a good question here.
I think there's some themes that some of you are touching upon. One of them is the issue of, this is how I am.
Can folks hear you in the back?
No. Sorry.
You want to stop this?
I guess some of the...
We have a microphone.
I'm okay.
Mic's camera. Mic's camera.
You're fine. Sorry. Some of you are touching a lot of... on similar issues, obviously. But how I'm interpreting one of the big struggles that we have, and I guess it's into the issue of how to deconstruct and build at the same time for future process. And I think of it as the issue of healing. Because while we're deconstructing, that's a lot of pain. A lot of issues are there. A lot of self-hate, thoughts or whatever. But there's also, the fact that some of us go through that process and push others, there's hope in that, right? And that's kind of like push forward. So I just wanted to see what some of you, and some of you have touched upon it, but I wanted maybe if each one of you could give me like a practical advice of what helps you, like own practical, like having a group of friends. I'm thinking like a very practical thing that we can do. And it's going to be different for everyone, but I would just like to see what helped you in this healing, like I said, recreation process.
Something better
if you're not thinking in terms of group work method. So I guess we're struggling to kind of find ways to reach this in light of the sort of discourse that tied to the economy, politics,
My question is related to the issue of landlord, because all of your work has been touching on that. Because in a lot of people from marginalized communities and from the third world, they also rely on the methods of what we call positivist science. So is it that when a person from the third world deploys those methodologies, are they being complicit in the hegemonic enterprise, or is it something that when the oppressed take over those methodologies, that they somehow transform them in a way that makes them do different?
I want to know more about what each of you does within non-academic communities, because sometimes I kind of feel isolated from an academic world, because I feel like even when we're having a conference about activism or ways that we can move past depression, it's like we're in a certain environment in which lots of the people that we're talking about wouldn't really come to participate like in this sort of discussion. So I'd like to know if you've written things for the general community, the non-academic community, and ways in which you've been able to work with the non-academic community even while you're an
academic. You all must think we're really brilliant.
I also, I'm really fascinated by this idea in this conversation between tradition and modernity and asking new questions of old stories. And old stories that I think are traditionally, historiographically, pedagogically, have disenfranchised many communities. So I think I'm concerned with ways of formulating kind of a pedagogical practice, and we'll give to our students, that disappears what I think Dr. Alexander says, a separation of particularly around domestic violence issues and the ways in which violence is coded in terms of familial property and notions of citizenship. And finding a way in which to kind of move from this kind of individual idea of practice and kind of self-affirmation into more collective forms of organizing and organizing against different alliances. And that's clear.
Let me just start with the one about how to incorporate spirituality into programs and research and teaching. I think one of the indigenous critiques of my book is that I did not pay enough attention to spirituality, and people asked me why that was. And my question and response usually is something like, can you, does this space deserve that discussion? Do we have a language for that discussion? It really does depend on the kind of the tools for talking about spirituality and the extent to which you uncouple spirituality from religion, and how that works in a public institution where there's a very powerful anti-speaking about religion move. And then it's really the extent to which, from an indigenous perspective, the notions of spirituality that people want to talk about in an academic setting can be spoken about when they're decontextualized from the indigenous community who hold those beliefs and practices and that connection. And if I just give you a very practical example, you know, I had students, because I'm also connected to a tribal university, and these issues are contested in a, you know, in the tribal university even more hotly than in the university I work at. And it comes down to say, like in our tribal university, we have to develop an ethics policy, and that's legislated. So in the legislation, you have to have an ethics policy for working with human participants and an ethics policy for working with animals. And the first barrier we got to is, what is an animal? Right, from our cultural perspective, what is an animal? So the legal perspective for ethics policies is vertebrates. That's the defining line, that you have to have an ethics policy that deals with vertebrates, but not necessarily for invertebrates. But from a cultural perspective, number one, we are all related. Humans are related to snails, birds, all living things. Humans have a responsibility for that relationship, and we're seen as guardians of our environment. So in our culture, what is an animal is a funny question. It doesn't make sense to us. You know, it's like, who are our relations? So then it's like, how do you develop an ethics policy that's practical? And how do you do that so you fit the law? And, you know, we really have to go and ask the students and teachers in the community, what do you want the teachers to do? And they said simple things. Well, when you take something from the sea, like a sea urchin or sea egg or a mussel, when you take it from its environment, we want you to acknowledge the taking of it from its environment. And if you're going to, when you're finished with it, is it in a position that you can return it to its environment, or is it no longer able to go back to its environment, then what do you do with it? So there are these really practical strategies for trying to deal with something that's really grounded in a worldview about people and our environment. So that's really the basis of my question around tools and language, is when you actually bring it down to the practicalities, you need to have those tools and really think through it. It's not just an abstract discussion about spirituality. It's about real practices and behaviours and that are part of a bigger system. So my question about, does the space deserve that? Is, you know, I'm not satisfied in our in the university I work at that the space is respectful enough. And in the tribal university, there are other issues at stake, one of which is the role of Christianity. And in the indigenous world, the role of Christianity with indigenous beliefs is one of those kind of no-go areas in some places. You've got to create a safe space for talking about and practicing and thinking about spirituality when, you know, we've got a whole fundamentalist Christian move that's happening in the academy. So it's very complicated. But I think there are lots of practical examples in our tribal university where they practice the compromised, institutionalized form of indigenous spirituality. You know, like the acknowledgements don't go on for 6 hours from midnight to dawn. They go on in a 10-minute space when you take an animal from the sea, or those sorts of things, that they are recontextualised into an institution, and that process transforms that practice to be something less than what it might be in the community. I think that, you know, there's a kind of, there's a real life extent to which you turn something into an academic curriculum. you take it away from the people who own that and who practice it, and their risks to that.
U.S. liberal feminism in the 70s couldn't have existed without the commitment of all those women to spirituality, and the way it manifested itself was through burning candles, playing the drums, and through music, and through invocation, and ceremony at the beginning and end of every meeting. The methodology of the oppressed that I write about is a spiritual practice. And what it means is that, and I think I say this in the book, that at any moment in political practice, there can be a punctum, that is a puncture, a breakthrough to the other side that we call conocimiento, the self-awareness, the amor in Atzlan, that imaginary space where anything is possible, that utopian space, up where the spirit lives. All of them, Derrida called it diferaz, the play of the chess game that goes on forever and ever and at every turn, revealing something new and different about the self and about power. But however we name the spirit, it gets imprinted in our activism. And Vivada said that the revolutionary must be guided by feelings of great love. And love and spirituality are linked, are if not the same. So this book that I wrote is about political practice and how political practice at every moment is inspired by the spirit. We were talking about this during the break, and we talked about the way in which, on the one hand, how do you generate this utopian sense of being that will keep you inspired to keep working when things are so bad, when people are experiencing such depression or a sense of overwhelm. And I like to think about it as, I mean, for me, I don't know if this is true or not, I haven't looked at the DJ, but I think the distinction for me is idealism on the one side versus utopianism on the other. Idealism is sometimes people are idealistic, and when they are idealistic, they don't realize, they aren't aware to the fact that we may be erased from what it is at any moment, and that we may not be able to have access to food or clothing or shelter tomorrow, or we didn't have food or shelter or clothing yesterday, and that our families are in danger. And so idealism, for me, is about not realizing all of the horrors and the dangers, but when one realizes the horrors and the dangers, and yet is still able to have a utopian sense of what could be possible in the future, a utopian sense of what's possible right now. If we simply imagine it and bring it into being and fight for it right now, that is where the spirit is, the conocimiento, the awareness of spirit. That what at any moment in political practice, one can experience that punctum to the other side, that utopian sense of being that one remains committed to in spite of everything. That's what Jesse Jackson means when he says, keep hope alive. In spite of all the ways in which we are wiped out of history, if you keep hope alive, you keep that utopia living. And in spite of all of you know about the horrors that exist. And all of that is a spiritual practice. And all of that is about the self-transformation we were talking about, the decolonizing process, the ways in which we read power inside of ourselves and outside of ourselves. All of that are both, these are both political practices and they're spiritual practices. Gloria and Zaldúa called it, said that we, in order to do this, we must become spiritual warriors. And she lays out techniques, technologies for going about doing, engaging in this political practice. And all of our books are about this. And these women have thought a lot about spiritual practice and how to bring it into material life in order to change the world.
See, one of the fictions that positivism has generated is that everything is separate. That's one of the fictions. Yes. And so it feels to me that in beginning to generate sort of radical knowledges, radical but different than positivism, if that's only an arbitrary starting point, is that part of what we've got to become connected to is, what are the cosmological systems from which we draw? What are they? What are the different cosmological systems from which we draw? And what do they tell us about our relationships to the world we live in? What do they tell us? Yeah? And to what extent do those narratives in those cosmological systems reflect themselves in the different places that we travel? Yeah? So we can begin by asking the question, I think, in those kinds of ways. So that's one set of questions. There's another set of questions about, what has organized religion done to spirit? What is organized religion? An organized religion really doesn't like spirit. Because the thing about spirit is that it doesn't like to be colonized. So it doesn't want to reside in any one place. It don't like Christianity, but it probably don't like Islam either. It doesn't like to be colonized. Yeah? And so the question, I think, for us, and the way in which I interpret your question, talking about spirituality, is where are the multiple spaces where something called spirit resides? And I think, in the way in which you were posing it, Jane, and it feels to me that it resides everywhere. And so the question for us is, how are we to be attuned to something that resides everywhere, that's both visible and invisible, that is both embodied and disembodied? So it walks with us everywhere. The question is, how are we attuned to it, and what kinds of narratives do we bring to explain its presence, its behavior, how we relate to it, what we do with it, etc. Now, just in relationship to my own work and the turn that it's taking and its own trajectory, I just have to do a slight little personal reflection, because I was very much aware, for instance, hearing, Shri Moraga talk very, very early that the gun on the cross had been signs of our oppression. And how are we to convert that into signs of our liberation? Or when Audrey kind of talks about the site of the erotic as a place of that profound kind of meeting of political, spiritual, ethical, sexual beingness. So we might all have a place to describe that place that we know the place, we've all fallen in love, we know the place. Everybody tell you not to love this person, and the hell with it, you're going to love them. We all know that place, we have had access to it. But we have all kind of fear of living there for whatever sets of reasons. So we don't live there all the time. We don't live in that space all the time. And to me, the core of thinking about ourselves as spiritual people in material world, rather than as material people making forays into a spiritual world, the challenge of thinking about ourselves as spiritual people in material world is how to make spirituality, and I'm doing it now from a deeply personal place and into my own exploration, how to have spirituality be the ground upon which I live, and how to make that the ground, how to make that the ground. And it is true, when I was involved in the struggle at the new school, we would, before our meetings, do prayers, put candles. And, in the Chronicle of Higher Education, they said that I was in charge of a cult. So we can laugh now, because we think it to be ridiculous. But it was a discord that was generated that was very violent. Mm-hmm. It was very, very violent. And that had profound implications for us internally, and what we could or couldn't do, and how the movement was delegitimized on that basis. So when I write in the way in which I write in chapter 7 about the movement of spirit, and the movement of spirit in the lives of working class women in communities of which I'm a part doing spiritual work, when I write about that, the least bit of legitimacy I want is from the academy.
I need to say that, like, underlined, in bold, in caps, in every way that you can imagine it underlined. The least place from which I want legitimacy is the academy. The academy only becomes my audience because it only becomes my audience because I happen to be given a mission to understand this operation of spirit in as many ways as I can make it intelligible. That's the only reason that you have access to it. Because it was a mandate that was given to me in the way that it was. I don't know if you understand what it is I'm meaning by that. I don't know how else to say it, but how I'm saying it. So, knowledge comes to you in different ways. Through research, through dreams, through intuition, through spirit speaking to you, etc., etc. So when you talk about, what's your name?
Sophia.
When you talked a minute ago, I didn't mean to stop you. When you talked a minute ago about this, you know, being a lot of pain, and like what's the recipe, etc., you know, this woman whose life that I'm writing, who was brought from the Congo to the Caribbean, and whose life that I'm trying to make intelligible, because she's telling me that what they write about me, they don't know anything about me. So I'm trying to make her life intelligible. And she says to me, healing work is the antidote to oppression. That's what she says. What am I going to do as a footnote? What is to be my citation of practice? I'm not to worry about citation of practice, especially because she also said to me, don't think that the things that I tell you, then go check them in these books and see whether they're there. You know, I'm giving these examples to say that allegiance to the academy, we shouldn't confuse. Okay, wait, you'll have to wait here. We shouldn't confuse the fact of our presence in the academy and even our attention to the rewards of the academy. We shouldn't confuse that with the reason that we have come into this existence. I don't know how else to put it. We shouldn't confuse those two things. And so if we can find a way to keep that tension, to live at the cusp of that tension of being in it but not of it, of knowing where our loyalties reside, or knowing that our loyalties are far deeper and far more, you know what I'm trying to say? No, they reside in a place that cannot be easily colonized. Yeah? If we keep those things present, then even the temporary setbacks, as in writing in the Chronicle that I'm part of a cult, is only temporary. It's only temporary, and sometimes actually beside the point. Although in that moment we think it is the point, but it's actually in the long run beside the point. And so the question to me about whether the academy deserved it, to me, any space that I reside has to carry it. So it's not a question of deserving it for me in that way, although I understand the way in which you're posing it, Linda. But I don't have to cull a vocabulary to talk about the spiritual in order to make it acceptable in this context. Do you understand what I mean? I don't have to do that. I've been given something to do, and I feel that I have to do it, and I have to do it in as many places and in as many spaces as I'm being called upon to move. And so now I understand in a way I didn't before, because all of it is a new learning. Now I understand in a way that I didn't before, that it simply travels with me, because it's part of me.
And I want to add to that that the Latin root for the word researcher is seeker. So when we talk about ourselves as activists, researchers, we're talking about ourselves as seekers, that we are seeking. We do not accept the world as it's been given to us, because we have this, the dream of the utopian world that is possible in us, and we are seeking our way toward it. And at the end of this process, I haven't forgotten that you will be participating in acts of truth-telling based upon this experience, this one word, idea, or concept that was uncovered. And in which, in those moments, we are calling upon ourselves to move. We'll be able to see the movement from and through idealism to utopia, to the acts of spirit, all of that will get manifested in that process.
I'm thinking about this. Recently one of the colleges of our university banned the use of Māori language before a meeting because it was seen as religious. At one level, New Zealand is a world leader in bilingual education and language revitalisation, but that still happens. And so this clash of, this perception of the blurring of language, identity, spiritual practices, culture, history, politics, religion are sort of delivered. They're delivered in an institution where something simple can flare up, someone wants to speak, and they're sort of put down because, you know, we can't have religion in here. And yet we get away, we've developed strategies where, and I acknowledge the land, that's part of our practices. But as an Indigenous scholar, you wear that identity in you, and so an attack on it is you feel it as an attack, on something quite dear. So it does kind of, frankly scare me to have a discussion about that in class. I know students will bring up particular issues, and in our culture there are different tribal variations, it's gendered, it's quite a complicated talk, and yet, with a sociological hat on me, I can see a politics around discourses of spirituality, and I can see some really interesting academic work that we could do in that area. But it's personally a scary area for me to go, and it's really about my own, I'm married into a family of healers. I really believe certain things, and I think it's a journey through different spaces, and as my grandma once said, it's the friends you pick up along the way, and the extent to which you bring those friends with you through those spaces is very powerful. Is extremely powerful, and if you believe it, you've got to be prepared to live it, and that's the issue. I think also when we spoke at the beginning about the mission you're sent on to come into these spaces, one of the ways our people deal with that is they do a ceremony which makes you like Noa. It's called Noa. It takes away the sort of tapu parts of you, so you can function in an ordinary setting. And that's, then you can just get out and do what you've got to do. There's also a developmental thing in there, because young people are expected to transgress all sorts of things, and that's tolerated. When you get to my age, you know, there's another set of expectations that you return to some of the fundamentals and those practices. So I guess at a personal level, thinking about how Indigenous spirituality might be discussed in an academic context is kind of novel. I don't have to really think about it. You know, so in terms of the research that we might develop, and I can see how people might teach about spirituality, and my fear is the extent to which that becomes a sort of nice ethnographic exercise when it's actually political and contentious, and then, well, then maybe it's a political exercise when in fact it's personal and deep and, you know, about your identity. It's interesting, but I think, you know, I know from our own young people, they kind of want to know. And the extent is this a place that you should find out about it? It's like, do you go to university to find out about your identity? And in some cases, yes, you do. Do you come to university to learn how to speak your own language? Well, in some cases, yes, you do. You know, and if a public university has a responsibility to enrich society and cultures, then that is a role that a public university must also have for Indigenous and minority cultures and societies. It must have this role of education and enrichment and enhancement. So I could probably work my way there. I'm not sure if that's what I want to do currently. I kind of stay at a particular level and leave it to those who I think have got more tools in the area of spirituality than I have.
Maybe later.
Did we want to move on?
Because it
segues really nicely into the next question, which was about healing and some practical advice.
Yeah, to me there's a way in which the questions that you all have posed are all interconnected. There's a real deep thread running through it. So, I don't know, I could take a stab at just kind of trying to put them together and then figure out what kinds of questions out of it. Because already I see the questions that you raised about, so, you know, if people of color adopt oppressive methodologies, do we make them revolutionary just by their fact of adopting them? No. do we know that, in a sense, right? In a very profound sense, no. I mean, so then what is the work of transformation? What is the work? What is the work of decolonizing? You know, is positivism? Does it ever have the capacity to be transformed? Yeah? And so, to me, the question that we are asking is a question about, you know, what kind of methodologies and what are the spaces where we can develop the kinds of methodologies that are complicated enough and supple and agile enough, right, to deal with the complicated intersections in which we live. So I would sort of just reformulate the question slightly, because we have a lot of historical evidence about how, you know, what happens when the neocolonial class assume power, for instance, if we were just to go there. Yeah? So we have a lot of that evidence that we know it's not an automatic transference then. And so it's then this really deeper question about how it is we... what is the kind of transformative work that needs to happen theoretically, analytically, yeah, spiritually?
And the step in between there, back to the story about the professor who said, the oppressed will do anything, will utilize any method in order to survive. Well, the step we need to take is this, that we need to decide as a people what methods we need to use in order to advance our ideas of egalitarianism and healing and hope.
how to bring about a true democratic state in any particular collective. Well, everybody has a different idea about the methods that should be used in order to do that, but it is in the process of determining what the method should be that we begin to identify the methods. In other words, we come together and we say, these are the skills we need to develop. How do we read as a collective the kinds of dynamics that we're confronting here and that we'd like to intervene in? Why do we want to intervene? To bring about more egalitarian relations between human beings, to bring about a sense of justice within the collective that we would like to make a difference within. So then we would together, all of us here, determine what kind of interventions we need to make on the outside, and we would read those power relations, and we would come up with varying kinds of methods that could be used, and any method is possible. Anything can be used in order to intervene in power, in order to change the power relations, to bring about more egalitarian conditions, and sometimes we'll make mistakes and choose the wrong method, and then we continue again. But it is in this step, and I think this is where all of our books are intervening. There's not been methods or techniques developed to enable us to meet together as a collective, to do the readings of power, so that we know how to speak to one another about it, so that we have shared vocabularies and terminologies and understandings, so that we know that so that we can make decisions about the kinds of methodological approaches we're going to use in order to make those interventions. And I think that's what this methodology of emancipation is, that has the spiritual dimension cannot be erased out from. Because here is where we are meeting now to discuss this step that's in between the methodological approach and our decision that something has to happen in order to bring about these more egalitarian conditions. Now, it's in the ways in which we speak to one another as a collective and the kinds of collaborations that we create.
Let me join your two questions together. Because one question was around the use of positivism, and another question was around kind of healing. Because I think both touch on a huge issue in decolonization literature and practices and like sovereignty movements and independence movements around the extent to when, as a community, you have control, what do you then do? And one of the underlying tensions is the default to conservatism that mimics the oppressor. And I know, the only examples that I can cite is this tension between the kind of the healing and the sort of sorting ourselves out, and the immediate tools at hand that we need to do certain things. That it is a constant tension. So, for example, some of our tribes had what are called settlements, treaty settlements with the crown, and we've had land returned and we've had money. And the crown sort of likes to think of this as a full and final settlement of a grievance, whereas I know the tribe I come from thinking, well, it's just like, that's this century. But the tension in the tribe is about, okay, we're ourselves now, we're responsible now, and if we think of ourselves as a nation, as a country, what do we have to do? What do we have to build? We have to build an infrastructure, we have to build an economic base, we have to build our culture, we've got to, we've got to do research, for example. We've got to evaluate what we do. And how do we know we're doing it? We need some data. It can be really scary, that the extent to which when you begin to think of yourselves as like a country, you have to start going to places that when you're fighting against it, you don't really have to think about it. You have to, are we going to get our engineers, our one engineer back? And are we going to get our scientists back? And what are our scientists going to do? Are we going to sort of demand that they do some sort of radical science that, you know, helps us but destroys their own careers as scientists? This attention, this constant negotiation about the tools that we use to build our house as opposed to the tools we use to dismantle it. And I don't think there's an easy answer. And I think the idealistic response is, you know, the people will decide. You know, but the people are all messed up, which comes to the healing part of it, is that I'm constantly ambivalent about the healing, because one part of me is going like, well, who should heal? But to me, the oppressors should heal. You know, they're the ones that should be the healing project. We need to get on with the business kind of project. We need to get practical and just see how we can move ahead. But at the other end of it is, you know, people who've experienced colonialism, it really messes you up. It messes your identity up. It messes the way you look at yourself in the mirror. It messes up the way you bring your children up. It messes up your relationships. So the healing part, I think, is really just as problematic. Because at one level it's, you know, it can be self-absorbing to me. It can be like, oh, good, another healing thing, you know. It's just like totally unproductive if people just get stuck in it. Because the danger of it, and I've seen it, the real danger of it is we beat ourselves up. We just constantly, and then when we finish beating ourselves up, we go and beat someone else up. You know, it kind of perpetuates this kind of inward examination that doesn't have the positive kind of move forward. And I think that was the point you're touching on. How do you heal as you move forward? And a Māori activist said to me a long time ago that as far as he was concerned, Māori activists were the most, you could all contest this, but most mentally well Indigenous people he'd ever met. That by acting, you are beginning that process of healing. That activism, you need to see political action as part of healing, as much as you might see some other activity, that activism is also a process of healing. And that healing practices cross the dimensions of, you know, political practices and spiritual practices and family caring practices, that those are all part of healing. But they're teachings. And I think that just goes with the decolonisation project that it requires a lot of work. And I'm not talking about that in abstract work. Abstract, you know, we've got high disproportionate levels of our people suffer from schizophrenia. Mental health is the largest health problem in our community. You put that with unemployment, you put that with domestic violence, you put that with poverty, you put that with educational underachievement, you are layering it up. And in real terms, it means every one of us, you know, in every family, we know someone who's in jail. We know someone who's killed someone. We know someone who's unwell, you know, mentally unwell. We know someone who lives in fear of someone who is unwell in their house. We know someone who doesn't bring their children up well. We know all these things. And it doesn't matter how well educated we are. That is our community profile. So when you're talking about healing, you know, at one level it's overwhelming. Unless you also attach it to action, to political action, because otherwise we'll just heal, you know, we clean ourselves up, there's another generation that's just been messed up. So it's a constant part of the agenda.
I just took a look at the clock.
Edge clock.
the oppressor's clock. Make sure that I have one on my head at all times. And that is agent to contact with me.
So I think that that now would be a good time to go to this moment when we reflect on the one word or one concept that is sort of resonating and residing with us the most, and write that on the card. If you need one, there should be some other extras around somewhere.
If you'd like to give your cards to one of us at the end, you can, or you can keep it if you're feeling inspired by it. Also, what we want to do is get your word, your voice out into the room. And we'd like no one to take longer than 15 seconds, and we may each take no longer than 15 seconds to respond to something if we feel moved to. In other words, we don't want to keep anyone's voice repressed here. So if we, Linda, need to respond to anyone's word, we can, here on the panel, can take 15 seconds to respond, but no long responses, either from this side or that side, or your side. So that's what the process will be. Are we okay with this? Are we okay with this? Yes.
We're having such a good time and the time, it seems abrupt. But I want to be clear that there's also another thing we're very hard on, that we don't want to push into that, right? And we want to continue. So let's just sort of. Folks, take it by section, and folks who want to speak their words into the room, we encourage everyone to.
Everyone has to do it.
Okay.
So you all come up with a word, an idea, or a concept, or I'm happy to have a word.
Borrow it.
No, this is your way to go and say it.
Oh, this is, thank you. The collective says speak. Seven.
The work of transformation.
Thank you.
Of hope.
Holism.
Being pulled and pushed.
Being pulled and pushed.
Sophia.
I guess in my reflection, what love is to me is spiritual action.
Love and spiritual.
Solidarity.
Secular religion, question mark.
Do you mean like capitalism?
Wings.
Pension.
Tension.
What was the word?
Tension.
Oh, tension.
Was the word tension?
Where are we?
Where are you?
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay.
Ancestrality.
Hmm?
Ancestrality.
Thank you.
Can't hear.
Ancestrality.
How about this man in the green shirt here?
Up front.
In the front. What happened? What's your word?
Is it friend? Did you give a word?
My word is glass.
Nice, glass.
Did you have a question back there?
No.
You're okay. Right.
I'm sorry, I don't know where we are. My phrase is love as an affirming action.
That's really good.
That's really good.
Word, idea, or concept?
Yeah.
Continual action renaming.
Continual action renaming.
Conocimiento de conciencia con compromiso.
Conocimiento de
conciencia con compromiso.
Humbleness.
Disappearing the idea of our separation.
You asked the question about the spaces, yeah.
Pushing through instead of running into the wall. The question is, there no longer a wall?
That's the borderlands.
Mm-hmm.
The borderlands. Is that not having walls? The borderlands of this, where the walls fall, you did in another space. The space
borderland.
Next to you?
Inhibiting language.
Yes.
Land.
What's your place on the land between us, where we are now?
I'm translating here. Feminine strength.
Feminist.
Female strength.
Can you stand up so I can't see you all that good?
Me? It's just because I'm the translator. I'm translating what you said. I'm supposed to be someone invisible.
So first, female strength.
Yes.
Okay.
Will those who didn't speak in the back stand up and give us your words so we can see you? Like you. I know you. Yeah. I know you gave your words, and I think you gave your words. What about you and me?
Physical strength.
Physical strength.
And you?
I just walked in. I don't know. It's a lot of words.
Sure.
Humor.
What?
Humor.
Humor. What's a good word? Humor. Did you get your word back there?
Yeah.
Me?
No.
Oh, would have.
Yes, yeah. Give it to him.
So did everybody get over there? Okay, let's move this way then.
Except for the translator.
The word invisibility to me is very, very important. Not only because I'm a translator, it's just a constant state of being for me.
Invisibility. Although invisibility as a strategy? Or just
yes,
invisibility?
As well. Or as just as a... as the being a victim of so many historical processes just that render me invisible, mm-hmm. render my struggle invisible.
Yes, make us feel invisible.
Yes, it's just a
we are not invisible.
Yes, anymore. Very multidimensional.
We feel invisible, but
yes,
invisible, and you are not invisible.
I see.
So did we work very well on this side of the room?
Or a concept.
Word idea or a concept.
My poem is a concept. We must find ways to work against our expectations, but in forward ways.
But in forward ways?
Came directly from all of this.
Thank you. That's good. Next. Let's keep moving. Let's move a little more quickly. So
Ubuntu.
Can't hear.
Ubuntu means working together.
Yes.
Compassion.
Self-compassion. Crossings are never complete.
Projects are never complete?
Crossings
are never complete.
This is an unusual academic group. I've done this before in an academic group, and in that last academic group, people would go give long speeches and everything. And this group is sticking to the one word idea. Next. I can't see you, so I can't, unless I really take this.
Relearning oneself.
Relearning oneself.
Section positivism is that everything is separate. We all have a mission.
Spiritual people in a material world, loyal to disappearing the idea of our separation. I can say it again.
Revolution or death?
And death is a revolution. Death is a revolution for us too. It's always with us.
Deep connections and multiple ways of knowing.
Of humanity or more broadly spirit. You need not learn about yourself.
You need not learn about yourselves, is that what you said?
Yeah, but,
You all hear her?
So that's all we're doing with the termination.
Go beyond the determination. Thank you.
Self-learning.
A conscious decision that comes naturally.
Assembly and gathering and scholarship, engagement and spirituality.
As
scholarship,
thank you.
As engagement and as spirituality.
And second row.
Abierto brechas.
Okay, thank you.
Constant listening to rhythm.
Constant listening to
rhythm.
Crossing over and over again.
And separating reconciliation, even with clarity.
I heard separate
unseparated reconciliation, even with clarity.
I heard unseparated.
Caracol. Covering the communities in a sense.
Summoning the community to the center.
Our grandma's agency.
We're reaching now the conclusion of this. So if there's any final words that any of us wants to say, now is the time for us to take that.
I just see this as a
as a sign, as a reaffirmation that we have to continue to insist on certain conversations and hold certain spaces accountable for creating this thank you. Everyone can make this happen.
Yeah, and perhaps, I mean, to go back to that issue of how just not to live in these individuated spaces is, you know, can we hold on to the idea that we put forward and commit ourselves to holding on to just one of them? You know, just one other one that we didn't put forward ourselves.
Jackie was just saying that one of the things that we've done is we've created our own nation here in the room, where we each now have citizenship, an alternative nation here. And part of the process in keeping that nation alive is in continuing to build shared languages and vocabularies. All of that has to do with building la facultad, the ability to talk about the signs of power in ways that no one is imposing on anyone else a final, ultimate reading, but rather we're generating our readings of reality so that we can then come up with movement, interventions that will benefit ourselves and those outside of this room. Anyway, welcome to this country. You are our country people now.
That's a lovely way to end this experience and move on to the next room. We have a wonderful performance planned and people are ready to go. We also have a reception and hope that we can all continue this conversation and build our